Let's say I asked Rosemary Wright, a dancer with whom I worked 30 years ago, to teach dances she performed for many years to another generation of dancers. If she demonstrates the dance without thinking about it, she will recreate each step and gesture perfectly on the spot the first time, as though she were a medium in a trance. That's muscle memory. Automatic, precise, a little scary. The second time through, however, or trying to explain the steps and patterns to the dancers, she will hesitate, second-guess herself, question her muscles, and forget. That's because she's thinking about it, using language to interpret something she knows nonverbally. Her memory of movement doesn't need to be accessed through conscious effort. Learning steps is only one demonstration of the muscle's intelligence. A virtuoso pianist is doing the same thing when he sits down at the keyboard and dashes off a piece of music he hasn't thought about in years. He has practiced and played the piece so many times in the past that the memory has never left him. It resides in the parts of his brain that govern his fingers and his muscles, not the parts he would use to ponder this sentence. Muscle memory has its uses in the creative process, perhaps more for acquiring skill than for developing inspiration, but it's useful, nevertheless. I know one novelist who taught himself the craft of fiction by retyping the stories of his favorite authors. The act of typing someone else's words, rather than simply reading them, made him stop and think about how the author chose words, constructed sentences and paragraphs, arranged dialogue, and structured a narrative. In this case, the exercise is less about muscles and more about perceiving structures and harmonies anew, from the vantage point of the author rather than the reader. Raymond Chandler and Proust went through a similar process when honing their very different crafts. Chandler believed Hemingway to be the greatest American novelist of his time, and he wrote imitations of Hemingway's style to absorb what he loved about it. Proust went further, spending 12 years translating and annotating the writing of the English art historian John Ruskin. He also wrote a series of articles for Le Figaro, imitating the styles of such 19th-century literary figures as Balzac and Flaubert. It's no different from a young person sitting with a drawing pad in a museum, copying a great artist. Skill gets imprinted through the action. If there's a lesson here, it's get busy copying. That's not a popular notion today. Not when we are all instructed to find our own way, admonished to be original, and find our own voice at all costs. But it's sound advice. Traveling the paths of greatness, even in someone else's footprints, is a vital means to acquiring skill. When I started out as a dancer in New York, I became obsessed with studying every great dancer who was working at the time, and patterning myself after him or her. I would literally stand behind them in class, in copying mode, and fall right into their footsteps. Their technique, style, and timing imprinted themselves on my muscles. That's one of the ways I learned to dance. I'm not sure how much impact it had on my choreography because I didn't end up creating dances like anyone else, but like a writer who writes more vividly because he has a huge vocabulary, or a painter who excels because of exquisite draftsmanship. I needed to hone my dancing skills in order to create. If I couldn't dance well, how would I have the authority to tell others how to dance, or know what a good dance was? That's the power of muscle memory. It gives you a path toward genuine creation through simple recreation. There are more flamboyant examples of memory, such as virtual memory, which is the ability to project yourself into feelings and emotions from your past, and to let them manifest themselves physically, Actors do this all the time. Every blush or flow of tears that's ever touched you in a movie results from a performer who's learned to mine the past. Actors train themselves to travel back to that beach 10 years ago and feel the temperature and the air, to find a link between then and now, and use it to give detail and personal resonance to a scene. You can even project your virtual memory into the future. Some business people do this as an exercise in visualization, imagining the ending of a sensitive negotiation as a means to achieving the desired result. They remember what a successful deal feels and sounds like, and they call that imagery up, seeing everyone in the room smiling and shaking hands. Then they retrace their steps to see how they got there and how they can get there again. The flamboyant Cuban chess master, José Capablanca, world champion through most of the 1920s, envisioned how the game would end and improvised his way to that point. The French ski champion, Jean-Claude Killy, I'm told, was a master at this. If he was recovering from an injury and couldn't take his practice runs the days before a race, he would rely on his memory of the mountain and picture himself racing the entire course. He would do this repeatedly until he felt the course implanted in his muscles. This gave him the feel of success. Then there's sensual memory, where the sudden appearance of a smell or taste or sound or color instantly floods the imagination with images from the past. One taste of those Madeleine crumbs, and Proust is suddenly embarking on his monumental In Search of Lost Time, previously translated as Remembrance of Things Past. We've all experienced sensual memory, whether it's the smell of oatmeal cookies hurtling us back to our childhood, or the opening notes of a song that induces reveries or nightmares of who we were with the last time we heard it. This is potent stuff, and it's there to be used. There's also memory that arises from your environment. Businesses, for example, are set up in a way that gives people far greater access to the inspirational power of memory than they realize. One of the more successful executives I know once told me that whenever he was feeling stale or creatively stalled at work, he read the contents of 4 or 5-year-old files. This seemingly mundane act of poring through old correspondence and memos never failed to